Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome. It's May 22, 2018, and in the Hebrew calendar, the 8th day of Sivan, 5778. I am Walter Bingham. Later in the program, you will find out what happens to the envelopes into which the El Al cabin staff asks you to place your leftover currency at the end of each flight. But first, this. Poland has again been much in the news, unfortunately under the heading of antisemitism. Actually, no surprise for that country. And in last week's program, I have again extensively reported on that subject. Today I have another, quite different story from Poland, a rather bittersweet tale. This report even fits into the larger scheme of things in the world today. Jews lost to other influences, and unfortunately there are many of those today. But this one is somewhat different. It doesn't concern today's Polish government, but the post-war political climate in Poland resulting from the Nazi rule. So besides those who were murdered in Poland, and I'm not afraid to say it, some with the help of Poles, there are other Jewish victims, of whom not a lot is known. What you will hear now may at first seem a contradiction. The Jewish Catholics in Poland. But that is very, very sadly true. In 2002, as part of the series Crossing Continents, broadcast at that time on BBC Radio 4 in the UK, and with kind permission of the BBC, I repeat it here, Rosie Goldsmith reported from Poland, and I thought it worthwhile to bring you today her revealing historic report.
It's 7 in the morning, and Father Romuald is holding Mass at a convent in the city of Lublin in southeast Poland. He and the nuns here have lived through turbulent times, the aftermath of World War II, communist rule, and since 1989, the shock of democracy and free markets. In today's Crossing Continents, I look at how Poland is emerging from the frozen decades to forge a new identity at the center of Europe. For many Poles, like Father Romuald, this regeneration process has begun by uncovering the secrets and lies of Poland's past.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Więc jako dziecko to bardzo chciałem być księdzem, jako dziecko, to znaczy, jako dziecko bardzo chciałem. I always wanted to be a priest. I was raised in a Catholic family. They didn't make me go to church, but we would go together. And I always had a strong faith. I was a devout altar boy. When I was young, people asked me who I looked like, my mother or my father. And when I was about 5 years old, someone called me a dirty Jew, and I was scared. I began to have some doubts about myself and suspected that something might be wrong. It wasn't prejudice. I just wanted to be the son of my parents.
At the age of 35, after you'd been a Catholic priest for 12 years, you made an extraordinary discovery, a discovery that changed your life forever. Father, it was your mother, in the end, who broke the news to you.
It was like being born again. My mother was living here with me. I was talking to her about the Holocaust, and I asked her, am I a Jew? She began to cry and said, don't I love you? I had my answer. Then she told me, your parents were wonderful. They were Jews. They were killed. I was only saving you from death. She said that my true mother had pleaded with her, saying, you are a Christian woman. You believe that Jesus was a Jew. In the name of that Jew, save this child, and one day he will become a priest. With those words, I suddenly understood everything about my life.
To jest moja mama i mój tata.
It's your Polish mother, your Polish father.
Yes.
What was your Polish mother's name?
Emilia.
We're looking at photographs of you when you were a child with your two Polish parents, and you really did not look like them at all. So a Polish family had saved a Jewish baby from the gas chambers at great risk to themselves, and Romuald was brought up Catholic. His adoptive mother could only tell him a little about his origins, that he'd had an older brother, Samuel, and that he, his mother and father were all murdered in the Holocaust. Under communism in Poland, it wasn't easy or even safe to live as a Jew. So Father Romuald kept this devastating discovery to himself.
You have to remember, Poland only became free in 1989. Before then, we could hardly talk about our history. Even in 1990, it was difficult. I saw graffiti which said, send the Jews to the gas chamber. Then I felt really exposed. Since then, there's been a revival of Jewish life in many cities. Jews are now free to uncover their past. They can be proud of being themselves. The worst thing is when a man is frightened of being himself.
Father Romuald still struggles to reconcile his two identities. He now calls himself Father Romuald Jakob Wechsler Vashkinel, using both his Jewish and Catholic names, a living symbol of two faiths. But for centuries before the Holocaust, Jews and Catholics had lived together in Poland without major conflict. Jews formed 10% of the population. Then, under the Nazi occupation, 3 million were murdered on Polish soil. Of course, there are many dramatic stories of Holocaust survival and heroism. But for Poles, many of these stories remain hidden. Today, even 6 decades later, not everyone can cope with the truth. I'm sitting in a flat in the capital, Warsaw, with a man who chooses to be anonymous. He's obviously nervous. He's a well-known figure in the arts, and he's about 60. He was brought up alongside his cousin, and they were like brothers. He's facing a very personal dilemma.
Ta historia ma mniej więcej tyle lat, co ja.
In 1943, my brother, a baby then, was thrown out of a train heading east. It was a train transporting Jews to the death camps. My mother and aunt happened to be at the station and found him. My aunt brought him up as her own son and as a Catholic. He doesn't know the story. During the war, his Jewish origins were a matter of life and death. After the war, I thought it was up to his adoptive parents, my aunt and uncle, to tell him. But they didn't. And now they're dead.
If you were to tell him tomorrow, what are you afraid of?
I'm afraid it would be too late. Some things are irreversible. The problem is, even if my brother wanted to, he wouldn't be able to trace his origins. There's nothing left. I think if you tell someone that their parents are not their parents, and they've no chance of finding the real ones, then you can cause a lot of pain. I didn't want to destroy his love for his parents when they were alive. And now that they are dead, I don't want to ruin his memories of them.
The personal pain in each of these tragic stories is palpable. Classic adoption stories, but here in Poland, they're burdened with history. The Association of the Hidden Children of the Holocaust has been set up to help. In a room above the Jewish theatre in Warsaw, a group of Polish Jews, all in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s, gather to share their experiences. When the association was founded a decade ago, there were only 4 members. But now, as more and more Poles realize that they're Jewish, or feel free to admit it, there are 800 members across the country. Piotrowska, you're the director of this group. Now tell me, what do you think you've achieved in the 10 years since you started?
Bardzo dużo. Przede wszystkim bardzo dużo.
She says they, as a group, achieved a lot. It's become the group of support for all of them. It's a family. For many of them, it's the only family they've got. Many Polish parents of Jewish kids are passing away. They think they can't take
the secrets, to the grave. So at the end of their life, they tell to their kids, I'm not your true parent. And these people who are at the moment 60 years of age, they've got to face a real problem. They are not the people they think they have been for their whole life.
And this group helps people like that.
Tak, oczywiście. To właśnie do tego jest potrzebna grupa wsparcia.
She says, yes, certainly. We provide psychotherapy for all of those people because they don't know how to approach the new situation. They don't know who they are. We try to help them to find a new identity.
Before the war, one third of Warsaw's population was Jewish. There were 3 synagogues. So who are the Jews in the new Poland? Tonight, in the one remaining synagogue, I can see all ages. The rediscovered Jews, the newly converted, the undecided, and some curious non-Jews. There are also visitors from Israel and the United States. Leading Poland's Jews today, and leading prayers tonight, in his charming mixture of Hebrew, English, and Polish, is Chief Rabbi Michael Szudryk. After the devastation of Jewish life here, and after the purges and anti-Semitism under communism, Rabbi Szudryk has presided over a remarkable revival of this small Jewish community.
It is pretty incredible. In 1993, the synagogue was attended by wonderful old men that never gave up the tradition. Almost all of them have since passed away. And I don't think in 1993 that we could have imagined that the synagogue would be full of young Jews as it was yesterday.
What kind of numbers are you talking about? How many Jews are there in Warsaw?
There is no clear answer. And this really goes to the heart of the matter. What makes this community unique? It's really a Central Eastern European experience. In 1939, there were 3.5 million Jews living in Poland. It's by far the largest Jewish community in Europe. By the end of 44, beginning of 45, 90% of those Jews are dead. For most people, it's too painful to even think what happened to the survivors. But there were 10% that remained alive. After the Nazis, during the communists, with the pogrom, with the purge in 48, and in 56, and in 68, Jewish survivors had 2 reactions. One was, if I want to stay Jewish, leave Poland. And the other one was, if I want to stay in Poland, I leave Judaism. This family secret remains a secret until the new democracy here in Poland. Some older people begin to say, I can now tell my children and grandchildren. Some children and grandchildren that suspected something didn't make sense then began to ask. And so some thousands of Poles in the last few years have discovered that they really have Jewish roots.
So you hear of deathbed confessions. That's how people are hearing about their Jewishness.
That's one typical way. Not the only way. I've had cases, heartrending, on 3 different occasions over the last 10 years, men who knew they were orphans, but didn't know who they really were. And on each case, they closed the door, locked it, and insisted on pulling down their pants. So I would certify that they were circumcised. It's a kind of a very strange never-never land. We have our Jewish tradition that if your mother was Jewish, then you were Jewish, and that we follow. On the other hand, if 50 members of your father's family were killed by Hitler because they were Jewish, then shouldn't they have a right to learn something about it if they want? And if they want to take that step to become part of the Jewish people, then we also should be there if they go through the proper procedure. Each individual needs to make their individual decision where they want to belong. Our responsibility as a Jewish community is to open the door.
And now I bring you 2 very special reports from Israel, which in a way have worldwide connections.
If you were ever on an international airline flight, you will have realized that it's not a very quiet or relaxing atmosphere. Besides the constant howl of the engines, there are many onboard loudspeaker announcements, often in 2 or 3 languages depending on the route, giving information and instruction to passengers. After the welcome greeting, follow the safety instructions. Sometimes they're accompanied by a video and sometimes demonstrated by cabin staff. Then they'll tell you that you will soon get something to eat and drink. From time to time, the captain will be heard talking about the route or the weather at destination. It seems to be never-ending. After the meal service, you're usually urged to peruse the catalogue listing the duty-free items which the flight attendants will be wheeling through the aisles to tempt you to buy because it generates commission. And then it's quiet for a while until the child in the seat row behind starts to cry or poke its legs into your back. You've all experienced that. Lucky are those who can sleep through most of the flight, but even they will at one point be tapped on the shoulder by a friendly cabin attendant telling you to buckle up because the captain has put on the seatbelt sign, or to put your backrest upright in preparation for landing, because that was the garbled announcement you've just missed. And then, when you thought it was all over with the audio intrusions until after landing, comes something that some people either miss or just shut off to, because they've had enough already, as the saying goes. I'm sure you know the feeling.
Hear what that is after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
And then comes something that some people either miss or just shut off to. It's usually a soft-spoken, friendly female voice drawing your attention to a small envelope among the literature in your seat pocket, into which you are urged to put your leftover foreign coins or even bills in aid of some nondescript charities to help children in need in underdeveloped areas of the world. The envelopes are then collected by the cabin staff. I'm not sure if that's done by all airlines, but it's the case in some. You certainly find it on El Al, Israel State Airline, but with an important difference. The charities are Israeli and are named, and so is the Bank Hapoalim that handles the accounts. So if you miss the announcement, it's a great pity. The money collected in El Al planes is distributed to Alut and Ale, two countrywide organizations helping disabled children in Israel. Alut is the Israeli Society for Autistic Children, and Ale cares for Israel's severely disabled children. You know, Israel is a country like any other, with all the good and interesting things, but also all the problems. Was it not Ben-Gurion who said something like, when we have thieves and prostitutes, then we know that we're a state, or words to that effect? Well, we certainly have those, but unfortunately, we also have many severely disabled people, both mentally and physically. I was so intrigued by that El Al initiative that I visited both organizations to see how they operate. So, I went first to the Jerusalem branch of Ale, where I was met by Shlomit Krajewski, who is the directrice, or director, if you like, of this center. Your organization, Ale, is nationwide and concerned with the well-being of severely disabled Jewish children. When was it established?
Ale was established 25 years ago in Bnei Brak by a group of families who had severely disabled children and did not find any proper treatment for the children the way they wanted it at that time.
Your literature claims to be Israel's largest and most advanced network of residential facilities for children with severe disabilities. At present, you have four centers. Are you planning any more in the near future?
As far as I know, we're planning to expand the present facilities.
What's the threshold to call someone severely disabled?
Severely disabled means, for our children, being severely retarded, not having any ability of speaking, all in wheelchairs, they're all incontinent, children who need help in every activity of their daily living.
Are the disabilities of the children for whom you cater exclusively caused by birth defects, or are there also other cases?
About 70% are caused by birth defects. There are other children who suffer from genetic disorders, some defined and some undefined, and some children who had home accidents, who were born normally and something happened in their early childhood.
I take it that Ale is a Hebrew word. What does it mean?
Ezer la'yeled hanache, helping the disabled child.
And how many children in total do you have in residential care around the country?
In Ale, there are about 400 children who are in residential care.
Are the children placed with you by the National Health Service, or how does it happen?
Children who are retarded are referred to us through the Ministry of Welfare. The social services feel that they're looking for a home for their children that can take better care for them. they refer to us, and then we have to see if we're suitable for taking care of them.
Is there a cost to parents? Who pays for all that?
Parents have some kind of an agreement with the municipality and the Ministry of Welfare. We get a certain amount for each child from the government. The parents have no financial agreement with us.
Do mentally or physically disabled make up the largest group?
With us, all the children are both.
Do you have boys and girls here?
Boys and girls.
And here at the Jerusalem branch, how many children do you care for?
We have here 72 children, ranging from birth, really a few months old, to 25.
Besides the usual bed and food, what other care do you give here?
Since we consider this home for these children, we have all the services that every regular child has in his own community we have here. We have a special education school who is run under the supervision of the government. There are special education teachers, a huge paramedical team, which consists of physiotherapists and occupational therapists, art and music and speech therapists, every therapy that you can need, because the only way of working with these children is on an individual basis. We have caregivers who are actually the most close person to the child because they see them 24 hours a day in a regular group who they belong to. We have a huge and a very, very professional medical team who takes care of the children, which consists of doctors and nurses 24 hours a day.
Well, now, can you show me what actually you do here and something about the daily routine? Well, Shlomit, where have we arrived now?
This is the music room where we work with the children on an individual basis. There are two kinds of items we have over here. First, regular music tools where the children can play and enjoy the way they can go for it. And the second thing is a sound beam, which you can see over here, which is a very big blue box where children who have disability of hearing can hear or feel vibration of the music via rhythm and strength of music. They can also produce music through a very, very light movement of a limb or the eye or something like that through this beam that you can see over here, which can catch the movement and produce a sound. And the children who can't talk gives them the ability of producing something.
And how do they react to all that?
They love coming here. They're the lovely teacher.
What exactly do you do with them?
I take the children into the room and try to help them express themselves through the music.
It must be a very satisfactory task when you see them reacting. I take it they do react.
They do react, and if I can see it, it's very satisfactory.
Thank you very much. We've now entered another room. There are quite a lot of children sitting here. Well, what is this?
This is a class, one of eight classes. The children in Alea are divided into groups, each belong to one class, and the staff consists of the teacher, a caregiver, and two other persons in the classroom because we need a lot of manpower to work with the children. As you can see, the children here are physically very, very disabled. None of them here except one, none of them can eat by themselves. Many are fed by tubes, as you can see for yourself over here. The medical treatment that they get is very intensive, but it does not push aside the rest of the education and rehabilitation we try to give them.
The young boy is playing with that box, probably filled with pebbles. He looks quite active.
He's a very autistic child. He's completely retarded, unfortunately. He cannot communicate to anybody, and he cannot take care of himself. That's what makes him dependent.
You said in the music room that they look forward to coming. What about here? Do they know where they are?
They know where they are. I mean, they can recognize their staff, because we insist that a regular staff takes care of the same group of children every day.
We're now walking through an area which has a lot of apparatus and wheelchairs. Everybody here is on a wheelchair.
Everybody. None of them can walk.
We've arrived on the second floor of this building.
This is the quarter for the young ones, children from a few months old to three and a half. We feel that we have to separate them from the rest of the children because they do have different needs. The baby you see over here is a child a year and a few months old. She's a third child to her family, non-diagnosed genetic disorder. Nobody knows exactly what she has. Checkups were sent all over the world, and there's no final definition to what she has.
Is that possible in this day and age?
Very much. We have many cases like that, that we see a syndromic child, we see a sick child, and there's nothing to point at and to recognize and to consult the parent in the future. We see her deteriorating. She can't do anything on her own. When she came, she weighed like 2.5 kilos, and the first mission we had is to stabilize her, to make her gain weight a little bit, that she can do other things, because first you have to bring them to a certain physical situation that you can do something else with them. And Baruch Hashem, we succeeded with her. She has a lot of seizures, which are non-controllable, as you can see for yourself, which makes it very, very difficult to go on.
How old is this little girl?
She's 1.5 years.
She's lying down in some cushion in the form of a toy and is looking out into the air, doing not very much, just moving around a little bit at times. We're now in a room with baby cots. I see there's one baby here. What's the matter with this one?
She's a few months old, less than half a year. She was born very, very sick. She's hardly any brain tissue. And we see her deteriorating all the time. As you can see, she's also convulsing. She has seizures now. You can see that. We haven't got any dreams that we can do that she can getting any better. But for her, the things we do is giving the best quality of life to what she has. If she doesn't have to suffer, if she doesn't have to go into hospital, if she doesn't have to have any painful treatment. So we know that for her, we did our best. So that's the way we were, giving every child the best program and the best quality of life according to their own needs.
This child looks as if she's blind. Is that so?
Most probably. No checkups were done yet, but most probably.
And also her skull is very much enlarged. And yet you say there's not much brain tissue.
No.
What's the prognosis for a child like this?
Nobody knows exactly what she has. They say a few months, the doctors, the geneticians.
We just see another child that's being wheeled in here.
This child is 1.5 years old. He was born as one of his twin set at a very, very early stage of the pregnancy. The other twin brother passed away immediately, and he remained. He suffers from premature symptoms. He had a very severe brain hemorrhage a few days old, and that caused him a lot of defects. You can see his skull is not formed in a proper shape. Still, he reacts very nicely. He develops. He's a very, very sweet boy, and there's a lot of work to do with him to make him exceed the highest potential that he has.
Do the parents come and visit here?
The parents are very much involved in every activity, in every decision-making process in Aleph.
What's the ratio of staff to children? Because each one in a wheelchair needs a lot of people.
I can say that for 70 children that we have, we had 150 workers.
How many of those workers are carers?
Carers meaning nurses and caregivers and teachers, the majority. I can say like 100.
How many of your staff have specialist qualifications, and what are they?
We have a lot of good professional people. We have nurses and doctors. We have physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, special education teachers. All of them are highly qualified.
There was a time you didn't worry about terrorism. It was something that happened in a faraway place or to someone else. But now you want to know. Now you want to understand. Now you're afraid that you might be in the danger zone. You need to listen to Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone every week, where you will find out the truth about what is going on in the world around you. Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone, right here on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
We have a lot of good professional people. We have nurses and doctors. We have physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, special education teachers. All of them are highly qualified.
And they're all full-time here?
Not full-time. They give us all the hours we need.
And here is a kindergarten. That's children, they look like 3 and 4 year olds.
Yes, 3 years of age, yeah.
How are they occupied?
Each has an individual program, which consists of many subjects. Here, now you can see physiotherapy treatment. Some having stretches. One child is standing on a stander to make her physiological position remain as much as it can. Other has respiratory physiotherapy. This is the session now. Later on, they have some music, they have some outings. Every day is different.
What about outings? Do you do that very often?
We try as much as we can. I can say that yesterday we took 20 of the big children, which was like a military operation. We took 20 of them to the seashore. All of them went with wheelchairs and the tubes. 20 children went. We had like 30 staff members who took everything. They had a marvelous time.
When you go to the beach, how does the general public react to this?
Most of them, I can say, are very supportive, very encouraging, giving good compliments to the staff.
All these children we saw, do they complete a normal life cycle, or is there a different prognosis?
It differs. Some children have a full life. I mean, there's no limit. Some children that you've seen suffer from terminal illnesses, and we know that they came here just for a short time, unfortunately. But still, that we react to children is that we don't take any consideration of their situation, I can say. Not in means of medical procedures, because for that we do consult and we do think of their prognosis, but for the means of buying equipment, for the means of investing manpower and doing programs and taking them out. And we treat every day like a new day, and we give them the best we can for that day, even if tomorrow is different.
But if there are children who are likely to lead a full and complete life to the normal end of one's days, at what age do they have to leave your home?
Alei Yerushalayim is actually built for children until the age of 21. Because Alei is looking at the full lifespan of these children, it builds up the new village of Alei Negev in the Negev, near Ofakim, that was built up to give these children until the age of 120. One-floor houses, a swimming pool, a pet farm, everything, occupation, everything that is more suitable for young adults and adults.
It's wonderful that you have that facility on El Al Plains, but from where does your main funding come?
The main funding comes from the government.
Sometimes people who wish to contribute like to stipulate what their money should be for, for instance, for a wheelchair or fitness item. Is that possible?
100% possible. Everybody can choose their own field. We can recommend what our needs are, but everybody can choose their own ideas.
I guess the information of how to contact you is on the website in English.
The website is www.aleh.org.
That's aleh.org. Shlomit Krajewski, thank you very much.
The second of the two beneficiaries of the El Al initiative is ALUT, a center for autistic children. I know that autism is classified by the World Health Organization and the American Psychological Organization as a developmental disability that results from a disorder of the human central nervous system.
I know also that the word autism, like many words, originates from the Greek and means autos, self, and was first used by the Swiss psychiatrist Eugene Bleuler in the 20th century about people who seem to have very little social communication apart from with themselves. To find out more, I went to their main center in Givatayim, just south of Tel Aviv, and there I was met by Buzi Merav Boaz, the director of business development, to be shown around their offices and subsequently their home, their complex. Before we started, I asked Buzi how autism manifests itself in the mature stage.
There's no autistic people that look like the other ones. They're different. Some can communicate and talk and read and write, and some cannot do all those things. Some can communicate with their parents, with the environment. They can speak their wishes, and some of them cannot do it.
I've now been taken to one of the residential homes and also the Center for Occupational Therapy. And one of the instructors here is Elisha Nakar. Welcome.
Thank you.
This center is in Kfar Ofarim, which is near Tel Aviv. We're now walking around here, and I see that it's a very modern and large establishment. Elisha, so what do you do here?
I work here as an instructor. We get here in the mornings to their houses, we wake them up, we give them breakfast, and then we go down to the occupational center, in which they are divided into different rooms according to their skills, where they spend the day. Some of them work, some of them just spend the day.
Are they all living here, or do you have people who also come for the day?
Most of the people here who are here in the occupational center live here, but some of them come from other hostels outside.
And how many people live here?
There are 72 autistic people living in here, in 8 houses.
Well, let's have a look at some of the rooms and see what they have to do. Here's a room where people seem to be just relaxing.
Yes, this is one of the day center for members who are either not motivated or are unskilled for working. So we don't try to force them or anything. We just try to make them spend their day in the nicest way. So you can see sofas and TV and a computer and there's books.
Maya, you are an instructor and I see you are comforting someone here. What do you do generally during the day when you don't do this?
We go to gym, we go out, we read stories.
Is it generally a one-to-one bougie?
No, Maya and the other instructor, they can work with several of them. They have like four, five, six kids to work with. It doesn't have to be one at one.
We're now entering another room. So what goes on here?
This room belongs to the occupational rooms where members do all kinds of different works. Some of them are factory works. Some of them painting the ceramic work before it goes into the oven. They do all kinds of different works here.
Am I right if I say that some people suffering from autism can be geniuses in various artistic fields?
Yes, definitely. And also in other fields. They can have certain skills that are extremely developed and others not so much.
Hello, you speak English?
No. Zara, no.
Mama, what is it?
No, no, your name.
Ah, you're painting some ceramic bird. Thank you very much. Hello.
Hello. This is for you very much, and you're very fair. Thank you.
Oh, we didn't get your name.
The word Oren Alter.
I am now in a different room where there is some kind of occupation that borders on factory work where plastic spoons are being counted and then put into bags. And the way they do this is by having a board with 10 holes in it or 12 or however many they go into the bag. And when every hole is filled with a spoon, then they know that it's ready to go into a bag. I make it very easy for them. Well, we've already heard that autistic people can be geniuses, and I'm now in a room where people are sitting at tables and are actually painting, and very interesting paintings too.
Some of them are really good, as you can see. I'm usually teaching them how to use the materials, different kinds of pencils.
When they've completed their painting, they decide that themselves when it's finished. What happens to the paintings?
We sell it to companies, to people that likes the colors, likes the shapes, and wants the drawings. And then we are able to buy the materials to keep the studio going.
When they're painting, do they make the basic drawing themselves? Is it their own idea?
Some of them, yeah. They do it from first line by themselves. The instructors does not interfere with the process, but some of them need some help.
There are some pictures on the wall. I see there's a frog dancing out of the water with a butterfly. Then there are buildings and flowers. I suppose if you wouldn't tell people where they come from, they would buy it and thought they were valuable modern art. How long does it take for someone to be able to actually sit here and produce a painting?
It's different, because some of the painters are making two drawings in one day, and some of them it takes weeks for them to complete and finish a drawing.
I see that they're coloring the pictures that are already drawn on the paper. Who does that?
Amir did. The painter did. He's doing everything.
Not touching in this picture.
Hello, do you speak English?
He's deaf and dumb.
He's working with very small brushes and a lot of different paints, and he's painting on silk. How long does it take him to produce a picture like this? Several weeks, we hear. When he completes a picture, is it easy to sell?
Yes, he's particularly, yes, because he's a brilliant artist. Yeah, but he's really good. And see this, is not painting, this is burning on wood.
Wow, that's something quite different. And it's electric, too. This is a woodcut that's being produced here by one lady. And then, of course, you can make as many prints as you like from it. She's working with a very hot iron. She's burning it into the wood. I see one instructor is working with materials. Do you speak English? These look like carpet samples.
We used it for pictures.
I see, for collage. Some pictures are a collage of material and paper. That's wonderful. How many Alut branches are there in the country, and are they all like this one here?
16 hostels for adults and adolescents, and 10 Alutaf, which is daycare centers for toddlers, and 10 occupational centers all around the country.
Talking about Alut, that's a Hebrew word. What does it mean?
Alut is Aguda Leumit Leiladim Autistim. That's initials of the Israeli Society for Autistic Children.
What happened to sufferers from autism before the time when these hostels were established? Were they just neglected?
Hospitalized in closed departments in hospitals, psychiatrist departments usually.
So they were treated as mentally ill and crazy?
Yeah, exactly. That's how horrible it was before the parents decided to establish a LUT and Leah Rabin was helping them.
Well, just walked through an open patio with benches where some of the residents are sitting. I think they call them friends here. Well, now we are in some fascinating place. What happens here?
This is like a more specified workshop where we work with bamboo branches.
Where do you get the bamboo from? Because some of these bamboos are very large in diameter.
And we buy them as a raw material and we use it.
Oh, I see. There's a whole rack of different sized bamboo. We've now got to a room where some of the paintings that we saw earlier being done have been framed. They're amazing and really worth hanging on the wall. They look like modern art, which they in fact are. Are they marked as being done by autistic people?
Some of the friends, they sign the pictures, see who's making it.
When you say friends, you mean residents?
Residents, yeah. We call them friends because they are.
But when the pictures are being sold, yeah, do the people know that they are buying a painting done in this home?
Yeah, some of them do, and some of them are amazed by the capacity of the friends, because some of them are really good painters.
Where are they being sold? Where do you display this?
In Beth Lessing Theater, we have an exhibition there, so everybody that comes to the theater can see and buy. Prices are listed, and it will stay there for a few weeks.
This is a picture about 30 inches by 24. What does it cost?
700 shekels.
That's including a plain wooden frame and glass. Are there people who come back and buy several of these?
Yes, of course. Companies, they are moving to new offices, are coming to furniture their walls with our pictures, our artists. And people that are going to hang it on their walls in the house.
How many people do you have in this bamboo room?
Different people. Each few hours I walk with three or four or five.
Can you explain what you do here and what you've got on display?
I'm cutting bamboo the shape I want, and I give it to the children to clean, to sand it, and to add some paint.
You've been handling one piece. What actually is this piece? It's a... Oh, I see. It has a lid, and inside are candies. And then there are smaller diameter bamboos topped with glass containers holding candles. There is one completed picture in a frame that I wouldn't mind hanging in my room. It's done by that very talented young man we saw working on silk earlier on. And it's a very intricate picture of buildings in the old city. I think it's worth a lot of money. Attached to this building is a domed structure housing a swimming pool. It's not quite Olympic size, but it's a very large pool. This is where they get a certain hydrotherapeutic treatment. Is it standing depth everywhere?
Yes, it is for the treatment people. The instructors need to stand up on their feet when they give the treatment.
So it's about 4 feet deep. And I see there are two or three people swimming. One of the young men in the water came over to me. One can stand up in it. Come and tell me your name, please.
My name is Amit, yes.
And you like to be in the water?
Yes.
How long do you spend in the pool?
Yes. No.
He's gone away now and swimming. You're the instructor? And what is your name?
Leo.
What do you do with them?
In the pool, mostly they like to be by themselves. It's like a quiet place for them to hang around in the water.
Do you do any exercises?
With them right here, no. Especially for those two that I'm with them right now, they are mostly here for relaxing.
How many people are working in this residential home?
More than 150 people, caregivers.
You also have other staff. How are they divided up?
Most of them are instructors, young ones. They have on-job training to deal with autistic kids. And some of them are therapists of all kinds, psychiatrists, psychologists, and a speech therapist, all kind of professionals that needs to deal with the kids' needs.
And that also includes the domestic staff.
Yeah, for the kitchen and people that take care of the home, of the rooms, cleaners.
I noticed while I was walking around that most of the residents don't take very kindly to strangers.
No, they don't react very easily to new faces and new sounds. They need their routine. So when we have visitors, we make sure that they come on the hours that the kids are not working, or most of them are not working.
I explained in the introduction how the Israeli airline El Al encourages its passengers to deposit their unwanted foreign coins in special envelopes for the benefit of the children's charities of Alut, which of course is yours, and Ale. How do the funds reach you, and how is it apportioned between the two organizations?
Charities collect the envelopes, put it in one big envelope of the flight. A person from Ale goes there to El Al, collects the envelope. He gets it up here, and we have the members counting it, dividing the different coins. And we deposit it in the bank, and we divide it. Half of it goes to Ale, half of it stays at Alut.
I'm actually now in a room with about 10 people, all of them autistic. All of them are part of the center. And they are actually opening these envelopes and counting the money. There are tables with all kinds of money, British and American money, Israeli money, even notes, and there are lots of dollar and other notes. And they do this every day because you're getting a parcel of these envelopes every day.
Yes, we do. We collect it almost every day. And for the autistic members, this is their work. They get up in the morning, living in the hostel, and coming here to work every day.
They are people who are living in one of your institutions.
Yes, hostels, a home for life.
What age are the youngest that you can put in here?
22.
And up to what age?
45.
With me now is the instructor, or instructress, to be grammatically correct, of this counting room. What's your name?
Zohar. Nice to meet you.
How long have you been doing this work?
I'm here for 2 months only, but I've been with them for like 10 years in Kfar Ofarim.
How are they instructed? It has to be learned.
You know, one by one, we show them and keep memorizing it again and again, day by day. This is the way to teach them.
And they can actually tell the difference between all the various
some
coins.
Some of them are, some of them not. Some of them just counting.
Some get the container with all shekel coins. And they put them on a grid, I see, of 100 squares, and they fill the grid, and when it's full, then it goes into a money bag, and that way it's easy to count.
Yeah, it's easy for them. They don't really know how to count 100, so we just draw them the line. Some of them do know. One over there, he knows how to count 100, so he put it on the cup and then in the bag.
One of the young men counting the money is sitting here next to me. What's your name?
Ishai.
How old are you, Ishai?
Nice to meet you, thank you.
You're helping to count the money, is it a nice job?
Yes.
Always in the morning you work here?
Morning and morning.
And then you go back home?
Home? Haifa.
Oh, your home is in Haifa, I see. And which is the nicest money?
Money, euro, and Israel.
Well, that's wonderful to speak with you, and thank you very much for telling me all that.
What's your name?
My name is Walter. Or if you want a Hebrew name, it's Ze'ev.
Ze'ev?
Yeah. And we will go on the radio.
Channel 7.
What?
Channel 7.
Channel 7.
Yeah, 7, you've got that. Yes, there it is. You read it off my microphone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Buzi, how much money do you collect this way?
Thousands of shekels each month we deposit.
Who divides it? Does the bank divide the money between Alut and Ale?
Money people are doing that.
Goes into the account, and then it's being dealt with by as a joint account. I see, being dealt with. Do you also get government funding?
We do get, but for development, the Homes for Life and kindergartens, we need donations.
You will find all their details on their respective websites, Alut and Ale. And now I have to end. So this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good week, and please make it also one for your elderly neighbor. Goodbye.
This is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.